This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. If you were a Martian, you might be thinking that your planet was being invaded by alien spacecraft. And you know what? You would be right, because a flotilla of space probes is headed to the Red Planet. A bit later in the program, we'll talk about new European, American, and Japanese spacecrafts that are on their way to Mars. But first, some head-scratching news about a probe that is already there and has been working for a year, snapping pictures of the Martian surface as it orbits the planet. The Mars Odyssey space probe is loaded with a suite of state-of-the-art scientific measuring instruments, and among them is the Thermal Emission Imaging System, THEMIS. That's a camera designed to take infrared, or heat, pictures of the planet's surface, the first pictures of their kind. And the pictures being sent back to Earth are so unusual, so unexpected, that scientists are baffled trying to explain just what the heck they are looking at. Just what are they finding and what this means in the search for extraterrestrial life, past and present? That's what we're going to be talking about. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and I invite you to go over there because we have a link to one of these pictures that we're going to talk about. And it's a very unusual photo. Well, before we get to it, let me introduce my first guest, Philip Christensen. He's the principal investigator of the THEMIS camera for NASA's Mars Odyssey mission. He's also a professor of geological sciences at Arizona State University in Tempe. Welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
Give us some background on the Mars Odyssey mission.
Well, it's been imaging for about a year. It has returned thousands of images. THEMIS itself is really a state-of-the-art way of looking at Mars. It's an infrared camera. It's the first time in 30 years we've ever sent an infrared camera to Mars. And so it really has opened up, as you say, some new horizons, some new ways of looking at Mars.
Now, on our website, we have a link to your website, which with something called the Bizarre Crater Mound.
we try to be exact.
Tell us why this is such a bizarre, unusual picture of a crater and a mound inside of it.
Well, craters tend to make holes, and they tend to leave holes. And when you find mounds of things inside them, it means that something has come along and filled in that crater. We see a lot of filled-in craters on Mars, and we think that wind and water play a role in those and in filling in these craters. But sometimes we look at these features, and you really can't say for sure what it is, and you end up just saying, well, that's bizarre, and leave it at that.
And so you did, and the bizarre thing about this is that the mound is even higher than the rim of the crater, correct?
That's right. There have been proposals that these craters may have once been lakes, and that would be fine. You could fill in a crater up to the rim with water. How you get a lake and deposits from that lake standing above the rim of the crater remains to be seen, and I think it really argues against water being the primary process that filled in these craters.
So then you've got to come up with something else, be very creative about the craters.
Exactly, and that's the fun thing with Mars right now. We have so much new information. We really are in a stage of scratching our heads a lot, but yet we know that with this information, eventually we'll come up with the ideas and it'll all make sense, and we'll stand back and go, okay, well, maybe Mars had glaciers that filled in the craters and the ice was frozen and it stood above the rim. And, you know, so it really is, it's providing us, just really forcing us to think new ways about Mars.
And now, this was taken with the THEMIS camera.
That's correct.
Was it missed with the regular camera that's not the infrared camera?
Many of the images we put on our website are visible images. It's because the visible camera has about five times better spatial resolution. You can see more detail. So oftentimes the images are more interesting, they're more spectacular to look at. But in terms of the new information, it's really the IR camera that's providing the real workhorse for Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some other unusual, unexplainable things that you've picked up.
Well, I've been working on Mars for a long time, looking at images, and I've even been looking at infrared data for a long time. The infrared part of THEMIS is basically like a night vision goggles. So we can take pictures at night on Mars and see what the surface looks like. And the main thing we're looking for there is, first of all, we're looking for hot spots. Were there any hot springs on Mars, any volcanic activity that would be glowing warm at night? But more realistically, we were looking for the physical properties of the surface. Rocks, large rocks, tend to stay warm at night. They hold in their heat. Fine-grained sand and dust gets very cold. So these temperature images let us see where rocks and dust are. And we've had this image that Mars was a dusty place. It has dust storms. Dust covers the surface. So I fully expected that our nighttime images would be fairly bland, show cold surfaces, not a lot of detail, not much going on, a surface blanketed by dust. And they've shown just the opposite. What we see is a surface with a tremendous amount of variability. There are rocks everywhere. All the cliffs and steep slopes on Mars are covered with rocks.
You mean smooth rocks that are standing out?
Yeah.
Not covered in dust.
Right. The type of rock that if you walked across the Earth, you would see, rocks strewn everywhere. This is interesting because it says Mars is much more dynamic than perhaps we thought. It's not, billions of years of dust storms piling up, thick layers of dust that cover everything. It's not like that. It's a dynamic place. The wind clearly blows the dust away, strips it off, exposes these rocks. We've even found places where there was solid rock exposed over an area, several miles in size. Again, that's not what we expected. We thought we'd go and see a planet that's basically choking in its own sediments.
Mm-hmm.
And that says something about the processes. It's a much more active place. The moon doesn't have rock sticking out. It doesn't have bedrock. It has, in fact, sat there for billions of years, collecting little bits of dust here and there. Mars is a dynamic place that varies from place to place. That's the other thing that I found most interesting is that if you land one place on Mars, you'll get a certain story.
Mm-hmm.
If you land someplace else, you can see a very different story.
Anything new about finding ice from the camera? I mean, if it's a night vision goggles and you're looking at heat, could you not see also where there's a lack of heat or more ice or water, frozen water at the poles or something like that?
That's exactly true, and that's exactly what we've done. We do, in fact, from the temperature, we can not only distinguish ice, but we can tell whether it's water ice or if it's carbon dioxide or dry ice. Just like you go in the grocery store, dry ice is much, much colder than mm-hmm. water ice. And we have, in fact, with the THEMIS camera, been able to see local patches of both kinds of ice, even in places where that wasn't expected. In the South Pole of Mars, there's a very large ice cap. Buried beneath it, we assume it's mostly water ice, but for several decades, the temperatures have indicated that the surface was covered by carbon dioxide ice. With THEMIS, with the very high-resolution images that we can take, what we found is there are little patches of the dry ice, or the water ice, sticking up through the dry ice. And that, again, doesn't make a lot of sense. We can see a place where there's exposed sand. Right next to it is water ice, and right next to that is dry ice. That really, it's hard to explain.
Wow.
You'd think if it was, how can all three of those
yeah.
surfaces be present within, a few hundred meters of each other? If it was that cold, you'd think the sand would get covered with ice, or if it was that warm, you'd think the dry ice would go away completely. Something's going on, and as you say, we're scratching our heads.
Wow, could you have had layers of all three and they're ablating at different rates? Or
that could well be, and that, again, gets to the question of a very dynamic Mars. This, something has to be going on actively to, the ice is going away, some process must be bringing it back. If this surface had sat there unchanged for, even a few thousand or hundred thousands of years, it wouldn't look the way it does. So
hmm.
it points active processes where the ice must come and go on a daily or weekly or yearly basis to make mm-hmm. the patterns we see.
Do these infrared pictures and all this interesting stuff make you want to visit these areas, or do they help you search for places where potentially life might have existed or might still be deep underground?
Absolutely. One of the things, the other thing we get with the THEMIS camera and with the infrared data is color images. Infrared, you can take color images as well, and it turns out that all minerals have very unique characteristic infrared colors. So we've been taking color infrared images and trying to map where different minerals occur. And again, we're finding a large differences. Some places we see minerals that definitely formed in water. There's one particular one called gray hematite that was discovered. It's actually turned out to be so interesting, that's where one of the U.S. rovers is heading, because this is a place that looks like a mineral formed in water. Mm-hmm. With THEMIS, we're seeing other places where we find minerals, volcanic minerals, which when exposed to water, they weather away very quickly, you know, hundreds to thousands of years. And yet we found rocks that must be billions of years old that still have their olivine sitting in them on the surface of Mars. And that says, in that place at least, Mars has been incredibly dry. Any water that was there must have been frozen. So we're seeing this unusual, you know, these conflicts. Some places looks like Mars had a lot of water. Other places it looked like it was unbelievably dry. To me, that's very interesting because it says Mars is, you know, it's a different place no matter where you go.
And so I mentioned before that scientists, and you were saying you're scratching your head, and so you have to really rethink about the dynamics of this planet and what's there to be even discovered.
Very much so. And if you think about it, Mars has the same land area as the Earth. I mean, we're looking at a large area, and it's not surprising to find places that might look right. Like, you know, tropical or, you know, humid places, dry places, icy places. There's definitely a lot to be discovered there, and we've sent three landers. We're sending three more. Even at the end of that, imagine going to the Earth and landing in six small little places on the planet, and trying to explain the entire planet.
So do you hope to narrow down eventual landing places for further probes and even maybe a human mission later on?
Yeah. Right now, from what we've seen with Odyssey, the equatorial regions look like today they don't have a lot of water. In the past, they probably had lots of water. The poles have lots of water, but it's very, very cold there. I think, for me, the most exciting place of Mars is the mid-latitudes, where there's evidence from the THEMIS camera and other observations that there's still snow present in the mid-latitudes. It looks like that snow might occasionally melt. There's a lot of landforms that look like glaciers. I think the mid-latitudes may be an excellent place to focus our next generation of exploration, places where robots can survive because it's not too cold, and yet there's still ice on the ground that melts occasionally. That, to me, seems like a really important place to go look for any life on Mars.
All right, this is quite exciting. I'm sure you're excited just to talk. Well, you get to see the pictures. So, and we also have the pictures on our website, which will take you over to the university's website, and you can look at these incredible pictures from THEMIS, which have sent back stuff that are hard to believe as we're talking about it. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and bring our guests, more guests here. We'll also bring Phil Christensen back. He's principal investigator of the THEMIS camera for NASA's Mars Odyssey mission and professor of geological sciences at Arizona State University. 1-800-989-8255. If you want to talk about Mars and exploring it, give us a call. We'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about old and new missions to Mars. Life, at least life as we know it, of course, needs water. So where to begin if you want to learn whether life ever existed on Mars? Well, look for evidence of water, either now or in the past. And that's just what a duo of NASA rovers is set to do by searching two very different sites on Mars for signs that rocks formed in the presence of water, proof that the planet was once a wetter place and so could have harbored life, liquid water perhaps. Rovers are scheduled to launch this Sunday, one on Sunday, and then one on June 25th. They don't have names yet. In fact, there's a contest for naming them with the school children. They're going to announce the names of the Rovers on Sunday. 6 years ago, you might remember, we were there at JPL on the 4th of July in 1997 as the Mars Pathfinder bounced onto the Martian surface. It opened like a flower and released the Mars Rover Sojourner. That was the first spacecraft to motor around the planet's surface and lay the groundwork for this search for life. This time around, NASA's not the only one going to Mars. A Japanese probe is back on track to the Red Planet. It had a rough start. Welcome to Exploring Space. And the European Space Agency's Mars Express is also en route to Mars. It launched successfully on Monday, we're happy to say. And hitching a ride with that orbiter is the British-built lander Beagle 2. It will search for actual signs of past life on and below the Martian surface. So for the rest of the hour, we'll be talking about these two missions and their robotic field geologists, armed with toolkits, mini laboratories to analyze rock and dirt samples on the Red Planet. And if you'd like to join our conversation, please, you're welcome to our number, 1-800-989-8255. And surf over to our website at Science Friday, where we have links to all these wonderful themis pictures on Mars. Let me introduce my guests. Colin Pillinger is lead scientist for Beagle 2 and the head of the Planetary and Space Sciences Research Institute at the Open University in Milton Keynes, United Kingdom at the UK. He joins us today from the campus there. Good evening, Professor Pillinger. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be able to join you.
Thank you. Albert Haldeman is the deputy project scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover 2003 project at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And he joins us today. Welcome to the program, Dr. Haldeman.
Good morning.
And also rejoining us is Philip Christensen. He's principal investigator of the Themis Camera for NASA's Mars Odyssey mission and professor of geological sciences at Arizona State University in Tempe. Let's talk about the Colin Pillinger. Congratulations on that successful launch on Monday. What's the latest report? Do you have any reports on it? How well it's doing on Mars Express?
We've been doing one or two things. We have released the Beagle 2 launch clamps. Hang on a second. I've got a real big feedback problem here. Could you talk to one of your other guests while I try to solve it?
We'll solve it. Thank you. Let me go right then to my other guests. Albert Haldeman, what's different about these Mars rovers that are going this time than the one that landed in 1997?
This time the rovers are bigger. The rover themselves is the spacecraft, where the Sojourner rover on Pathfinder was about the size of a microwave. Mm-hmm. These rovers are the size maybe of a very small car.
Wow.
I'm also having a bit of feedback.
We'll see what we can do. These are not, are they going to go up to a rock? I remember the first rover, they rolled around just within a very few feet, very few meters of the station there. These are actually going to run a little further away?
They will. They have a capability to go about the same distance as Sojourner went in its whole mission. They have the capability to go in a single day. That was about 100 meters that Sojourner traveled, and we will be able to travel up to that distance per day. Probably we'll find so many interesting things that we won't go quite that far each time.
And what will you be looking for? What kind of interesting things?
Well, like you said earlier, we're in the business of trying to determine the history of water and climate on Mars as a stepping stone to picking out the history of the habitability of Mars in its past. And we're going to do that by looking at rocks. And in particular, we've picked two landing sites, one of which Phil, who is also, I should say, Mr. Infrared on this mission too. He's in charge of the infrared spectrometer that both of our rovers carry. The hematite location is one of our chosen landing sites, and we'll be looking for geochemical evidence for water's activity at that landing site. And the other landing site we've picked is a crater lake, or at least that's one of the explanations for its...
What do you mean? I noticed on the photos a little river in it that might have flowed
exactly.
into the lake.
Exactly. The interpretation is that the channel flowing into the crater and then the channel to the north that flows out of the crater would have ponded in the crater and created a lake there. And we hope to find evidence for that ponding, or whether it was an ephemeral lake or whether it survived for a longer period of time in rocks on the crater floor.
Now, sometimes you get accused of all missions that we have, whether they're manned or unmanned NASA missions, that you play it too conservative. In other words, you go to spots where you're going to have a safe landing because it's relatively flat, but you might not find a whole lot there. It's like landing in the desert. You know, you get a good landing, but you don't have a lot of stuff to look at. What about this mission?
This mission, that's the reason that we have mobility. We're going to bring with us a capability to drive up to 600 meters or a kilometer, so about half a mile during the mission, and that, we believe, given the orbital information we have, we'll be able to take ourselves to interesting deposits and interesting outcrops within the safe landing ellipses that we've chosen, which, you're right, they're fairly benign and fairly flat to ensure increase our chances of landing safely. Mm-hmm. As it happens, the very interesting hematite deposit turns out to be one of the flattest places on Mars anyway, so one of the most interesting places chemically and mineralogically on the planet turns out to be one of the safest places to land. So we lucked out there.
Colin Pillinger, let me bring you back in. I hope everything's working better now.
I think it is. Much as I like the sound of my own voice, I don't want to hear it four times.
So you were telling us the state of how healthy is your spacecraft now?
Yeah, well, as I was saying, we've fired the launch clamps to release Beagle 2. It's ready now to be spun up into the atmosphere of Mars when we get there. The European Space Agency has had a practice burn for its main engine on the Mars Express, and they're very happy with that. We were on a very good trajectory when we got away from Earth. Everybody was very satisfied with the place we were aiming, so... Everything looks really, really good, and I hope it stays nominal all the way.
Now, it's been described as looking like a pocket watch, and when it lands on Mars, it's going to open up and stay there. There's no rover inside of it, but it has all kinds of experiments it can do right there, correct?
It also has different ways of navigating the surface. We've got this device called the MOL, and to us, an important direction to go in on Mars is down. The MOL is able to get below the surface a meter and a half. But rather than go straight down, I've always believed that the most exciting place that you could go with the MOL would be under a big boulder, which might have been in situ for ever since it was deposited there. And that's the sort of place where you could have permanent shade, so you might get a damp spot. And, you know, that means it could be a place where it harbored some kind of microbiological activity. But most certainly it could have been protected from the harsh oxidizing environment on Mars, and that would allow us to analyze for things that haven't been eroded away by the oxidizing potential of the atmosphere.
So you're actually going to look for signs of life on Mars?
Both past life and present life.
And how? I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have an experiment which is capable of looking. We look for water in the samples. Everybody's always said this. We look for water. We also look for the minerals that are deposited from water, because even if water is a transient, it leaves behind certain minerals, particularly the ones we're interested in are carbonates. If a mineral is deposited from water, then trapped in that mineral will be the organic relict matter of any organisms that lived in the water column. So we'll be looking for the organic matter that is associated with the carbonate minerals if we can find it. If you look at that kind of evidence on Earth, you see it in rocks that go right back to 4 billion years ago when the planet first became solid enough to support living organisms. To take it beyond that, if we're looking for current life, which is what is another of our ambitions, instead of trying to do what Viking tried, which was to see if there were any actively metabolizing organisms at the site where it landed, we're going to examine the atmosphere using the premise that if there are organisms somewhere on Mars, the waste products, even if it's 1,000 meters down or, you know, somewhere near the poles, the waste products of metabolism will leak out into the atmosphere. So by scrutinizing the atmosphere, if you can find products that shouldn't be there but are produced by biology, then you may have discovered that there's life somewhere on the planet. You might not know where it is, but it at least encourages you to go back with more informative techniques to perhaps seek it out.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys in competition with NASA?
Nobody's in competition with anybody. We all share the information. I'm fascinated by what they're doing, and I hope that they feel the same about what we're trying to do. The only thing I know that increases is Only commodity I know that increases as you share it is knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering, you know, you guys were actually looking for signs of life, and NASA's looking for just the presence of water. I was wondering if you had cooperated along the ways in designing your instruments and spacecraft with each other to complement one another.
Not at that level, but I'm sure you'll find if you dig deep enough that there are some Europeans involved with the Mir rovers, just as you will find if you dig deep enough that there are some American investigators involved with Mars Express and Beagle.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Manny in El Cajon, California. Hi, Manny.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question, it deals with the water that has been shown to be on Mars. I read a couple of articles that talked about the erosion patterns of that water on the surface of Mars, and they seem to indicate geologically a short-term catastrophic event. The erosion patterns aren't very mature or well-developed, and how would that negatively impact on the prospect of life being on Mars?
Who wants to grab that one?
I can take a crack at that. There is indeed evidence of catastrophic flooding and short-term flooding, but there is equally evidence, in the same about as controversial as the catastrophic flooding evidence, that there were standing bodies of water, that there were shorelines ringing a northern ocean, or for that matter, even shorelines inside Gusev Crater indicating a standing body of water. So we have evidence both ways, that there were very ephemeral, sudden events involving liquid water, as well as longer-term standing bodies of water.
Phil Christensen, there are Themis pictures actually showing snow-covered crater ridges. Is that correct?
That's right. We see very high-resolution imagery that shows gullies that are recent. We see evidence of snow. I think one of the things that's coming out of recent results is that Mars may, in fact, be frozen a lot of the time. There's a lot of ice and snow and glaciers. Sometimes that probably does melt catastrophically and flow across the surface. But we've also seen this mineral evidence that says there's minerals that most likely formed in water where the water was there for a long time. So I think there's a lot of water on Mars. It's frozen a lot of the time, but it's very interestingly, it's not always frozen. It occasionally does melt. And even snow and ice can be very important abodes for possible life.
Mm-hmm. Let me just jump in with a little station break. Let me just say.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Colin.
Oh, okay. There's been a lot of talk about things happening much more recently on Mars than we believed in a few years back. And almost any geologist, no matter as soon as they've looked at a rock, the next question they will ask you is about when did this happen? When did this rock form? When was it? When was the event? And that's one of the spin-offs of the Beagle lander, is that whilst we're looking for evidence of life, we're actually trying to date some of these processes absolutely, like when the rocks that we pick up were produced and how long they've been on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I think this is information that's critical. We need to know just how active Mars has been in the recent past.
Phil Christensen, you're in charge of the one of the instruments on the new rovers. There's a Themis on it, right? There's an infrared camera?
It's related to Themis. It's actually more closely related to an instrument we have in orbit on the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft. Again, it's an infrared instrument looking for minerals. Just like from orbit, we mapped the entire planet, tried to find the most exciting places, interesting places to land, and we found a few. Now we're going to get on the surface. If you remember Pathfinder, you look around and there's hundreds of rocks, and it takes a couple days to get over to one and position the rover for detailed studies. What we want to do with this infrared spectrometer is map the composition of all the rocks we can see, find the ones that maybe have this hematite in it or might have a vein of carbonate or something else that's exciting, and then point the rover in that direction and then turn it loose for its really detailed measurements that come from the other experiments.
Mm-hmm. And tell us, Dr. Haldeman, what the other experiments on there are equipped.
Well, the infrared spectrometer, the thermal emission, the mini-TESS, mini thermal emission spectrometer, and the color cameras are located on a mast. And we use those, as Phil said, to locate our targets. And then when we drive to them, we have a set of instruments, four instruments on a robotic arm that we deploy to the target position on the rock or on a soil deposit for that matter. And we have a microscopic imager, which is like a geologist's hand lens, and that provides us a magnified view of the rock up close. We have two spectrometers, an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer that gets at the elemental composition of the rock, and a Mossbauer spectrometer, which provides us information about the iron minerals specifically in the rock. And those two things, we can look at the outside of the rock. The fourth instrument is the rock abrasion tool, affectionately known as the RAT, which also happens to be built by a company down the road from your studios in Manhattan. Manhattan goes to Mars. The RAT will drill inside the
Is that why
the
they
rock.
Called it a rat? No. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Being a New Yorker, I can't resist that analogy.
There's a rat on Beagle as well, but it's not a rock abrasion tool. It's a radar altimeter trigger. There are all manner of rats going to Mars.
Well, there are 8 million of them in New York. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. I think they're getting
That's
rid
fine.
Of them on
the,
Mars.
The rat will get us, through the dust and through any rinds or weathering rinds that are on the outsides of the rock and let us hopefully see something like a third or a quarter of an inch into the rock, which we hope will be inside any rinds, and look at a more pristine nature of the inside of the rock, mm-hmm. look at its the way it was when it formed, and get at the minerals of the rock specifically. And then we'll also learn about how Mars is affecting the outsides of rocks in the interim time.
I know being at the JPL when the first rover was rolling off the platform that it landed on, I remember watching people holding their breath. Was it going to get off this thing without tumbling off its platform? This is going to be carrying all its instruments, not like the original one that had left a lot of the instruments on its platform, right?
That's right. This the rover is the spacecraft. This rover can walk and chew gum. It can not only roll on the surface of Mars, but it can also fly itself from Earth to Mars. The spacecraft computer that flies to Mars and then also executes the entry, descent, and landing system is the rover's computer as well. Mm-hmm. And so this rover drives on Mars. It's also Neil Armstrong to land on Mars, and it also knows how to fly between planets.
Wow, what a talented rover. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about missions to Mars. Take some more of your questions, so don't go away. We'll be right back. You're tuned to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. The Pentagon plans to pull out of its permanent bases along the Korean Demilitarized Zone and establish them south of Seoul. Join Neil Conan on Monday in this hour for a discussion of the new strategy and what it says about America's military presence in the rest of the world. We're talking this hour about two new missions to Mars, about also stuff that's already at Mars and exciting things that might be happening in the near future as we send these probes to Mars. Our number 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Albert Alderman of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He's the deputy project scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover 2000 project, as yet unnamed. You just call it the rover. Colin Pillinger, lead scientist for Beagle 2, head of Planetary and Space Sciences Research Institute at Open University Milton Keynes. That's in the UK, just across the pond. Also, Dr. Phil Christensen is principal investigator of the Themis camera for NASA's Mars Odyssey mission. He's also a professor at Arizona State University in Tempe. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. As you can imagine, lots of people with questions. And also a question that refuses to go away. John in Chico, California. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead. Give us that question.
What's up with the infamous face pictures?
That face on Mars.
The face
Whatever
on Mars.
Whatever happened to that face on Mars? You still believe in it, John?
No, I am curious what it is and what they came up with on it. So, like I said, I've been wondering. I've been reading. Yeah. I haven't seen anything in print about it.
Phil,
I'm just wondering.
Let me ask Phil Christensen, who's been taking pictures of Mars. The face didn't show up again, did it?
Well, we did image the face. We've imaged it a number of times. We recognize that it's an image that's well known in the public, and there's a lot of interest in it. Interestingly enough, it doesn't show anything other than what you'd expect from a normal geologic process. But the first picture we took of the face really provided some of the first clues of this idea of snow on Mars and snow melting to form gullies. So it turns out the face is actually looks like it has some of these snow deposits on it. But other than that, it's a standard run-of-the-mill Martian hill that's happened to be eroded into an unusual-looking feature.
Does it still look like the face?
No, if you look close, I mean, it looks like, you know, you get up close and look at it, it looks just like any old hill. You have to get the lighting just right and the resolution just right and sort of squint a little bit, and then sure enough, it looks like a face. But it's just a hill.
One thing that's of interest is it's located in the northern lowlands, and it's the scarp around it that kind of forms the frame of the face in the original Viking images is at the same level as some of those mapped shorelines. So one of the interesting things is way back in Mars's past, this may have been beachfront property on an island.
I like that. Aren't you gentlemen all betting that life, because if it existed on Mars, has to be pretty similar to life on Earth because you're looking for the same kind of life? Could it be different? Could it be of a form that you can't, you know, our instruments would not detect?
I don't think any of us believe in silicon-based life. I think we all think in terms of carbon-based life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we've tried to be reasonably general with the Beagle Project, is that what we're trying to do to detect whether there is life on the planet is to find this relict organic matter within water-produced minerals. We're not being prescriptive about the nature of the compounds we're looking for. We're actually trying to see whether or not the organic matter has got a different carbon isotopic composition to the atmospheric CO2, which would have been gone into the minerals. Because when you... This is the one of the tests that you do on Earth to see whether life started back 4 billion years ago, and it holds true right across the entire geological record. So we're sort of hedging our bets here. We're not looking for the right kind of any particular kind of chemistry.
Right.
We're looking to see whether or not carbon species get diffused through membranes, and because that's what essentially fractionates isotopes.
Any that Mars meteorite that supposedly had little submicroscopic evidence of life, that has that basically been discredited at this point by NASA?
Absolutely no way is the entire story of the Martian meteorite being discredited. What I've worked on this for 20 years. What we've been able to do with a lot of the things that we show from Martian meteorites, we can prove that they took place on Mars by measuring the isotopic compositions. The two things that we can't show is that the things that people have suggested might be fossils and the minerals that they believe are biogenic, you cannot prove, or organic matter indeed, which I've found in Martian meteorites, and I can give you arguments which are circumstantial to say that that's indigenous to the samples. But you cannot prove any of these things are Martian. And they all could be something to do with some demonstration of terrestrial contamination. So Beagle is in fact going back to look at these things anew on Mars, where we can eliminate terrestrial contamination. And I'm sure, like the Mir rovers, we've spent a great deal of our time making sure our spacecraft isn't taking terrestrial organics and other possible organisms to Mars to confuse our experiments.
Let's go to Ken in Stuttgart, Germany. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. We know that the Earth undergoes periodic climate variations. The last ice age wasn't that long ago. So isn't it possible to correlate what's happened on Earth, perhaps if that's due to solar activity, with what could be happening to give rise to a dynamic Mars? And secondly, real quick, why not explode a bomb on the surface of Mars? If we were to send a bomb to Mars, that would really shake things up, and you might be able to get a good feel for what's underneath the soil by dispersing that in the Martian atmosphere. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
As to exploding a bomb, I don't think we have to do anything that radical. All we have to do is wait until a meteorite of sufficient size impacts, when we've got all of this armada of orbiting spacecraft there, and we'll be able to look at
the idea, the first thing you do when you get to Mars to explode a bomb, certainly doesn't ring true with me.
Your correspondent actually should be aware that there's a proposal under consideration currently within NASA of a skim sample of the Martian atmosphere, which would endeavor to bring back Martian dust from the atmosphere. We don't need to be anything as drastic as dropping bombs. Thank you very much.
What about the night and day stuff he was talking about? The different seasons? I'm not quite sure the point he was trying to make.
Well, I think there is very good evidence of climate change on Mars. And in fact, I think ice and glacial features, there's evidence that things do change, and that, to me, that's what makes Mars particularly interesting, because its climate changes. And in fact, it may not be very typical of its long-term history of what we see today. That climate change has a lot to do with the tilt of the Mars axis, which varies quite a bit more than the Earth. But there really is a lot going on there. And if you went back to Mars 50,000 years ago or 50,000 years from now, you might very well see a Mars which is quite different. And what we learn from that climate record clearly will influence our understanding of how the climate is changing here on the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pillinger, can you give us an idea what the Mars Express is going to be doing?
Yes, I'll do that if I may, but could I just comment on the last question again, is that it's short term that we can do this, but when we finished analyzing solid samples on Mars, we intend to monitor the atmosphere for 6 Earth months to see if we can detect any changes in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of been known for 200 years that the poles on Mars apparently evaporate, so we may be seeing something transferred through the atmosphere that could be very interesting. Mars Express, to come back to that, is it's got a number of very interesting experiments on there. Perhaps it's got high-resolution stereo color camera, which will complement what's already going around the planet. Most interesting, I think, people will find the results that come out of the ground-penetrating radar. We've been looking at, with Themis and obviously the neutron spectrometer on Odyssey, at the very upper surface of Mars, but the ground-penetrating radar is going to go down kilometers, and that's going to show whether or not there's a big reservoir of Mars of water below the surface. The other two main experiments on Mars Express concern the composition of the atmosphere and watching how that changes with throughout the Martian year.
Mm-hmm. Talking about exploring Mars this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And those poor Japanese with their probe that's been in space for years now. Can anybody know what's the status with that? It was launched and ran into trouble. It had a rocket orbiting problems and had to come back to Earth to get a little slingshot effect from the Earth a couple of times. Anybody familiar with that? No?
That's about as much as I know as well.
My understanding is that it's had a few more hiccups, but it's still en route.
That's the learning curve in space, isn't it?
That's right. It's still en route, and my understanding is that they will do the final flyby this summer and be en route to Mars for arrival when the rest of us get there.
Let's see if I can get another call before we have to go. Kevin in Anchorage. Hi, Kevin.
Why don't we explode an atomic bomb? No, I'm just kidding. What's always drove me crazy is why, since Viking, why haven't we landed on the polar ice cap? You know, because it seems like to me that's where life would make a last stand. You know, there's ice worms that live in glaciers, and are there special problems landing on the ice cap, pole?
There's real special problems in trying to analyze wet samples with mass spectrometers. The last thing vacuum scientists want are water in their systems. I'll be real happy if I get a sample with sort of less than 0.5% water in. I want to see the minerals that are deposited from the water, not the water per se. It confuses instruments really badly.
Any other gentlemen, Dr. Haldeman?
Well, we did. NASA did try to land near the pole, not on the actual ice itself, in 99 with the Mars 98 lander, which was fated not to be, unfortunately. And certainly the poles are still a target, very present in the minds of the Mars community as a potential landing site, in part for the reasons that the caller mentions.
The loss of those two Mars probes, has that kept a pall over NASA until this time and over JPL?
I don't think so. Certainly we were all very disappointed with the outcome back then, but have redoubled our efforts to make this next attempt very much a success.
All right, we've got about a minute left. When does it get to Mars? When should we start looking for it to land?
You should be planning to be in Pasadena on the 3rd of January, Ira, with Science
Friday.
It's a New
Year's celebration.
That's right. The first the one that launches Sunday is then, and I believe Beagle gets there before we do. We arrive on the 3rd of January and the 25th.
We get there at 2:54 a.m. on Christmas morning UK time, so it'll be Christmas Eve with you.
No kidding.
You'll be still celebrating when we're trying to get our kids to bed.
So you'll be making overtime that day.
We worked overtime last Christmas, so this is nothing new for Beagle.
Mm-hmm. Nor for the Mars Exploration Rover project.
No, I'm sure we're very common. We've got common ground there.
See, and you're before telling you, me there's no you, friendly rivalry here? Listen no, to no, this.
No, there's no rivalry. We all know about working a lot of hours. And before we check out, please accept my good wishes for your launch on Sunday. We'll be rooting for you and look forward to seeing
absolutely,
you on Mars.
Absolutely, and my congratulations on the release of the clamps.
Any idea what the name is going to be? That they can announce the winning names on Sunday?
The announcement's coming up either Saturday or Sunday, and I have no clue what it's going to be.
And this is a competition for kids, right, for school children?
That's right, students K through 12.
And
there were 9,000 entries of pairs of names. They were sifted and selected and voted on, and headquarters made the final selection. NASA headquarters had the decision.
All right, we'll try to get those names up on the Science Friday website as soon as we know about them. Gentlemen, good luck to all of you, and we'll be watching.
Thank you.
If we can get to JPL when it lands, we'll be there. So stay tuned to the station. Colin Pillinger is lead scientist for Beagle 2 and head of the Planetary and Space Sciences Research Institute at the Open University of Milton Keynes, UK. Thanks for taking time and staying up with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Albert Haldeman is deputy project scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover 2003 project at JPL in Pasadena. Thank you for joining us today.
Pleased to have been here.
And last but certainly not least is our first guest, Phil Christensen, who is principal investigator of the Themis camera from NASA's Mars Odyssey mission and professor of geological sciences at Arizona State University in Tempe. Thank you for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
And that's about all the time we have. Let's talk about who produces this program. Annette Heist, Adrian McDonald, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. And if you missed any of the links we talked about today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, we've got that link up there to that weird, bizarre crater, as they call it, on Mars. You can take a look at it, and it'll take you to the site to see more pictures. And if you'd like to send an email to us, surf over to sciencefriday.com. You can also find Science Friday's Kids Connection, free educational material for students and their teachers. And also, you can download Science Friday on your Audible player or listen to the archives of Science Friday on Real Audio. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.